You are listening to WPVM LP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina. And globally at WPVMFM.org.
Well, howdy, buckaroos and buckarettes.
This is A Better World, coming to you from the studios of WPVM 103.7 FM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. My name is McNair Ezard, and I'm your host for A Better World. Each week, we take an in-depth look at the people and organizations locally, nationally, and internationally who are working to create a world that works for everyone. And our guest today is Kevin Ahern. He is Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan College in New York and past Director of the Peace and Justice Studies and Labor Studies Program. He is the author of Structures of Grace, Catholic Organizations Serving the Global Common Good. He has also edited several books, including Public Theology and the Global Common Good, and he is Director of the new Dorothy Day Center at Manhattan College and holds a PhD from Boston College. And Kevin is here today to talk to us about Dorothy Day, founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. Kevin, welcome to A Better World.
Great to be with you, McNair.
Appreciate you coming on today. So let's get started. Tell us about kind of generally who was Dorothy Day.
Well, I think some of your listeners probably have heard of her, or many might have heard of the great hippie from the 60s, Abby Hoffman, who described Dorothy as the first hippie, as the original hippie. But Dorothy was, I think, one of the most important figures of 20th century New York, in my view. Obviously, I spent a lot of time with that. I'm biased. But she was an activist, a mother, a grandmother, a Catholic, someone who tried to live her understanding of Christianity in a serious way. And that brought her to oppose war as a pacifist. That brought her to work with the poor and live out what the Christian tradition often describes as the works of mercy. But Dorothy, in a lot of ways, was an average everyday human person, right? She wasn't something abstract or far away. She was an embodied person who really tried to take seriously what she saw as the commitments of her faith.
So talk about a little bit, if you can, about kind of the timeline of her life that led her to her involvement in social justice type issues.
Sure. So Dorothy was not born in a devoutly religious household. It was sort of nominally Episcopalian. She was born in New York, and then her family moved to California, where her father was a writer for one of the most popular sports of the time, which was horse racing. And so he was a journalist covering the races. And Dorothy spent a couple of years in early in San Francisco, or near San Francisco and Oakland, when the 1906 earthquake took place. And as a child, she saw, and this was a transformative experience for her, and there's a book for children, a children's book about this, she saw her mother and her neighbors welcome and take care of the people who were fleeing the fires of San Francisco. And that really transformed her understanding of service, I think, of commitment. And she writes about this in her autobiography, The Long Loneliness. Her family then moved to Chicago, where she was sort of aware of the social movements of the time, right? This is in the early 1900s, 1906, when, you know, only a couple decades after these labor struggles that took place in that city. And she was inspired by that. She wanted to be a journalist and a writer like her father. And she went off to study in college. And I often tell my students, you know, I would love it if you copied her, but just not on this one point, because she dropped out of college and moved to New York when her parents and family moved to New York City. And she had this dream to become a writer, but her father didn't really feel like journalism was a place for women at the time, and sort of tried to call up all of his friends that were that were in the writing industry and say, you know, don't hire my daughter. But Dorothy found a job in Radical Papers at the time in these magazines. She had, when she was in college, she had already gotten involved in sort of radical politics, especially concerns for the poor and for the working poor. This was a time, of course, where the Russian Revolution had just recently happened. And she was in this, there was this hopefulness that before we knew the real dangers of what Sovietism would bring about. But there was a hopefulness that maybe we could get past czars and we can move past monarchy. There's a hopefulness for participation, for justice, for the working poor. And I think she was excited about that. So she started writing for a few radical papers and magazines in New York, like The Masses or The Liberator. She was invited by some friends to go down to Washington, D.C. with a group of women protesting for the rights for women to get the right to vote. And she and others were even arrested down in 1917 in front of the White House for women's suffrage. Although as an anarchist, she never exercised the right that she voted that she got arrested for. So all of this before she became Catholic and before she really became a committed Christian, that she was living this activism of anarchism, of pacifism, of justice, of commitment to the poor. And she was a writer in a time in New York City and in Greenwich Village when there were a lot of other creative thinkers. Eugene O'Neill talks about how she, you know, they would be drinking and talking and smoking in these bars. There was one bar that was called the Hell Hole in Greenwich Village. The name of it is the Golden Swan. And if anyone goes to New York City, there's a park called the Golden Swan Park, and that's where this bar was. But Dorothy would be talking with these thinkers, these creative people. But she would also, after spending all night out drinking or celebrating or and thinking and imagining a new world, she would see the poor of New York City going to churches, going to Catholic churches. And she would be drawn to go into church with these people for early morning mass. So even before her formal conversion to Catholicism, she had this draw to religion. She went to Europe for a little bit. She had some experiences which led her to believe that she could never be pregnant. And she fell in love with another anarchist, another activist named Foster Bataram. And they bought a shack. She bought a shack with money she got from the movie rights to a book that she wrote. So I'd say this to my students. Even before we know her as a Catholic saint, potentially, this woman in her 20s had the audacity to write an autobiographical novel. And that's interesting. And it was published. And not only was it published, but it was then purchased. The movie rights were purchased by a Hollywood studio. And with those movie rights, she was able to buy a little shack on the beach on Staten Island, which is a part of New York City, which has a beautiful beach, actually, and it might surprise people. And so she lived in this shack with this man that she fell in love with, and then she found herself pregnant. And this was, for her, a miracle. And she didn't know any Catholics other than, you know, a few people that she knew socially. So she went and stopped a nun that she saw on the side of the road who was working at a nearby orphanage and said, I want my baby to be baptized. But this was a real problem because the father of the baby was against organized religion, but also was against the institution of marriage. So Dorothy had to make a choice. Either she went all in with this new religion, or she stayed with this man who didn't feel compatible with her desire to get married. And so she decided to go in with her understanding of her new love for Jesus and this understanding of what the Catholic social tradition was. She saw Catholicism, and maybe it's different now, but as a religion of the poor, as a religion of the working class.
That must have taken a lot of...
So we can,
Yeah, I was going to say that must have taken a lot of courage on her part to separate from him, to follow her faith, even when she didn't when it wasn't a mature faith at that point.
Yeah, and you know what's amazing about that story is they were deeply in love with each other. He was very principled in his anarchism. He believed marriage was an institution that he did not want to have any part of the state. But of course, as a Catholic, you couldn't live with, you couldn't have a common law marriage. You had to actually marry, and it didn't even have to be in the church. And she just begs him in a letter and says, "Just get married to me. I won't talk to you about religion. I'll raise the daughter on my own, but we won't talk to you. We won't bring you into this." Mm-hmm. And he, in his principled state, said no. But they kept in touch for decades until her death. And in the 60s, he had another partner that he was living with. And that woman got sick with cancer. And Dorothy even went and this is a total act of, for me, amazing act of love, you know, in a deep sense of love. She went and helped nurse this woman. The current romantic partner to her love of, or potentially her love of her life, which I just think is beautiful. And, you know, they shared a daughter together and they shared grandchildren together. So that's you know, they were in touch with each other.
There was a little bit about her journalism. I read that there was a point in her journalism journey that she was kind of traveling. Maybe it was after she had her daughter that she was traveling around writing kind of travel log kind of thing, but she was like really bored with it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think she was a creative person and but also very principled. And she was trying to find a way to mix together her principled sense of activism, her desire for community, with her desire to be a journalist or to be a communicator, right? Like, I think people who talk about Christians often talk about St. Paul as being a great evangelizer or something, but that's really a communication person, right? Mm-hmm. Dorothy felt like her professional life as a journalist, which, of course, in the early 1900s, there were very few women journalists, right? And very few women who were single mothers and working as journalists at the time. You know, she wrote a column for the Staten Island, one of the local Staten Island newspapers that was a gardening column. So as part of the efforts of all the documents we had to send to Rome for the canonization, we have all these articles about Mrs. So-and-so's petunias or other flowers. But she took a job writing, actually, this is a part of her story that isn't well known, for the places in California for some movie studios as a writer. And she moved with her daughter, Tamar, out to California and for a short period of time, because then the Great Depression happens. And Dorothy writes one letter where she says she's one of the last writers left in the studio because she's a woman that they fired all the men first because they were being paid more. And eventually that job ends, as so many jobs in the Depression ends. And she travels a bit and she comes back to New York and she starts writing for some Catholic papers. But it was in 1932 where there was a great hunger march in Washington, D.C., organized by groups of socialists. And Dorothy was covering that for some Catholic magazines. And she saw these massive numbers of hungry people during the Great Depression, unemployed and desperate people, some veterans of the First World War. They were asking their government for food, for justice, for jobs. And she had this deep moment of prayer. She had already converted to Catholicism, but she went and she prayed in December 8th, 1932, for a way for her to bridge her faith with her journalism and her activism. And when she came back to New York, she met this man, this wandering mystic, this very fascinating human person, Peter Morin, a French man, who was at her doorstep saying, "You should start a newspaper." And she was like, what? Excuse me? I'm sweat. She writes about how she was, you know, off the bus from Washington and she missed her daughter. She wanted to see her daughter. She wanted to bathe. You know, after many of us who travel, like the last thing we want to do is have a conversation as soon as we get home after a plane ride or a bus ride. And this man kept hounding her, saying, you're going to start a newspaper with me. And 6 months later, without any money, they start the Catholic Worker newspaper in May 1st, 1933.
Yeah, I read an article, an interview she did with a publication called The Agitator, where she was asked, how's the work you do in the city with the poor related to the work you do as a journalist? And she said, you can't write about things without doing them. You have to live that same way. What do you think she meant by that?
Yeah, I think that's a real challenge for a lot of us. You know, I teach in my class about war, about peace, about serving and working with the poor, about these ethical values. But then I often wonder, well, am I going to put a mirror up to myself? How am I doing? What am I doing? And I wonder, and I try to be honest with my students that I'm trying my best on these things, but I'm not 100%. And I hope I can try to get close to at least 50%, maybe. But you know, we know that one of the big things, especially young people, but all people point out, is hypocrisy. And Dorothy was writing about the need to serve the poor, but if she wasn't actually doing it, then what's the point? So the first issues of the Catholic Worker paper were talking about the need for the Catholic Church to feed the hungry and clothe the naked, work for the poor, give food to those who are hungry. And people started knocking at the door of the newspaper asking, well, where's the soup line? Where's the food? So the newspaper office became a soup kitchen. And then when they're talking about the need to oppose war, The newspaper office became a place where they started to organize protests. And so Dorothy really wanted to make sure, and this is a very unique and difficult path for a lot of people, that she practiced what she preached. And that's a real challenge for people of faith.
If you just joined us, you're listening to a conversation with Kevin Ahern. He's Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan College in New York, and he's also the director of the new Dorothy Day Center at Manhattan College. And you're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org. Okay, that's the St. Christopher Chamber Orchestra playing the Oboe Concerto in F Major by Bach. And today our guest is Kevin Ahern, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan College in New York. And he's here talking to us about Dorothy Day, founder of the Catholic Worker newspaper and Catholic Worker movement. Kevin, what was her ideas about voluntary poverty? Because it seems like that figured greatly into her work.
Yes, right. So as we were saying, she started this newspaper, and this newspaper started to turn into a soup kitchen and a community. People started staying there. So it went from a newspaper effort, which she, I think, initially just thought it would be a newspaper, to becoming a community and then eventually becoming a movement. And one of the core values of the Catholic Worker movement, and there are over 100 Catholic Worker communities around the world today in about 15 countries, one of the core values, in addition to nonviolence and community, is voluntary poverty. And the Christian and the Catholic tradition have a long conversations about this notion of voluntary poverty. Many people will know that nuns and priests often and brothers often take vows of poverty, right? And it's becomes more interesting and challenging for Dorothy as a mother and later a grandmother to live a life of voluntary poverty. For her, that meant a way to become close to Jesus, or a way to practice her faith, was to become, to empty oneself, like Jesus does in the Christian tradition, that God becomes a poor in a baby in the backwaters of the Roman Empire, that Dorothy chose to become close to the poor. That meant living in the same community in the same conditions. It meant eating the same food. It meant not taking salaries. It meant really living close to the people who you were serving. And so if you go to Catholic worker communities around the United States today, you will often maybe find it difficult to figure out who is the guest and who is the member of the worker in the house. There isn't a class differentiation of dress or food difference, or people are living together and trying to form a community. And for Dorothy, that was a very important notion. She really believed that Christianity values poverty as a way to become close to the poor. But it was also a way to reject the dominant forms of capitalism. And it was a way to reject being implicated in what she saw as the violent structures of the U.S., of federal government with taxes and the war machine, as she would describe it. So voluntary poverty for her, I think, is a really radical idea, and it's a really beautiful idea.
So was she supportive of Roosevelt's New Deal overtures? Because that came about, I think he was elected in 1933 or took office or somewhere around there, and he started the New Deal. What was her thoughts about that? Did she ever talk about that?
Yeah, excellent question. So Dorothy, as a pacifist and an anarchist, she was very skeptical of anything coming out of the federal government. Now, you can see in the early days of the Catholic Worker paper some real interest in the labor laws and the labor regulation coming out. And of course, we have, you know, Perkins and other people who are coming from New York, and Roosevelt himself coming from New York, and you know, the legacies of the labor struggles with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and all of that. So Dorothy was supportive of some of the labor questions, but very skeptical of having laws being the solution to all the problems. And this is a tough thing for a lot of people to get around, I think, sometimes, because as an anarchist, she believed that the solutions to the problems had to happen from the bottom up, not from the top down. She believed in what she described, and which she sort of helped to develop, as a school of Christian personalism, where the revolution begins from the bottom up. So she was a revolutionary, but the revolution begins not from Washington, but from the hearts and from the people. If all Christians just practiced what they preached, right, you wouldn't need a New Deal, is what she was, I think, getting at. So this is why the Catholic worker movement and many Catholic worker communities, there is also not a national or an international structure, as there would be with a lot of nonprofits, because they abide by a sort of anarchist principles where each community can do their own thing and does their own thing. But so there's a lot of diversity within the Catholic worker world today. But Dorothy believed that that communities should not become tax-exempt organizations, because if you become a tax-exempt organization, you are in some ways collaborating with the government that she believed was a problem. And so this is, you know, really hard for, I think, you know, a lot of people interested in Dorothy to understand her rejection of not only, you know, the government, the U.S. government and all governments, but also her refusal for the communities to get tax exempt status, which would be very helpful for, let's say, you know, property taxes in New York City, for example, or making donations at the end of the year, right? So a lot of Catholic worker communities do not have any of that formal recognition by the government. They could get it, but they choose not to.
So let me ask you about yourself before we get too much further along. What led you to be a professor at Manhattan College, and how did you get exposed to the work of Dorothy Day?
Sure. So I was a college student in New York and grew up with a family that always had the Catholic Worker paper. And it's you can subscribe to it for there's a sent a copy if you want.
Even
and
now.
even now it's still a cent. So it's a nice thing. So I grew up with that in my household. In college, I went down to the Catholic Worker and volunteered a bit as a student, and I encourage students now to do that. And this was around the time of the in 2002, 2003 with the second Iraq War, and was working with folks from the Catholic Worker and other allied movements in opposing the entry into what we believe to be an unjust war. And so I was attracted and interested in the activism that was happening there. I spent a lot of time years working internationally in a global Catholic youth and student movement, doing organizing work in different countries, and then went for my doctoral work and writing about faith-based social movements. So came back to New York and went to Manhattan College, which is now Manhattan University. And we I was sh seeing in the classroom whenever I taught about Dorothy, students would perk up. They can't put this woman in a box. They can't figure out, wait, is she conservative? Is she liberal? What is this? What she demonstrated for the rights for women to vote, but she never voted? What's going on, right? She's not like the grandma that we think the stereotypical grandma, pious Catholic, but yet she was deeply faithful. So it's she breaks barriers and stereotypes, and I think that's really fun to teach. I was invited to work with the people who were working for her canonization cause to make her a saint. And I'm very committed to that because I want more people to learn about her. And I want kids, I have three little children, and I want children like mine to learn about her in their religious education classes. I want the Christian commitment to peace and nonviolence and the Christian commitment to the poor to not be hidden in our society. And I think Dorothy, as a saint, along with many other saints, both Catholic and not, right, both official and unofficial, I think do that as they challenge our understanding of what Christianity is. So that's kind of my hope. So we created a center at my university, Dorothy Day Center, which in part is an educational outreach program on justice issues, but we also have an exhibit and a display of items from Dorothy's life. Dorothy, she, fascinating person, but she on many fronts, but her commitment to to labor justice and her commitment to peace led her to do acts of nonviolent civil disobedience, sort of in a Gandhian style. And as far back as the 30s, and her last arrest in 1973 with at the age of 75 with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Worker Movement. And there's a famous picture of Dorothy of her sitting on a stool surrounded by California state troopers with a broad-rimmed straw hat on. And we have in our exhibit at our university, in our student center, we have that stool, her shoes, her skirt that she wore that day, her purse, and the hat. And so it's a way to get students and others into thinking about what activism is, but also what Christian discipleship should be for those who are Christian.
You mentioned about her. The process for canonization, which I want to ask you more about at the towards the end of the show, but I understand that the lives of the saints really loomed large in her life. Is that true? And can you talk about that?
Absolutely. In her bedroom, she had a lot of books about saints, alongside books of Russian literature and poetry and all sorts of other books. But the lives of the saints were very important to Dorothy. She would pray a lot, like a lot of Christians do, this daily prayer of the office, this ancient Christian tradition, but that would often include prayers from saints old and new. One of the saints that was deeply inspirational to Dorothy, might be surprising to some of us, was a woman, Saint Therese of Lisieux, woman that was called the Little Flower. And Saint Teresa, she was this nun who rarely left where she grew up, was in a convent where she was for the rest of her life, but she was And she had this notion of the little way, a way of revolution. And this is what I think fits so well with Dorothy's understanding of revolution. And I had a student work with me this past year on this, who wasn't Christian. And so it was great to have a student be inspired by this, that this little way, that little things can be transformative, that you have to start with the little thing. How do you say hello to someone that you pass by? What are the little acts of kindness that you can do, even at great personal sacrifice, gritting your, biting your tongue when someone says something kind of annoying at the lunch table, right? But that you could start a revolution from a seed, from the bottom up. And Saint Therese, in the Catholic tradition, is seen as a major figure and a patron of missionaries. And here's a woman who never left her convent and died when she was so young. So that's one saint that inspired Dorothy a lot. Dorothy was also inspired by early Christian saints who were pacifists, right? Who committed to nonviolence. There were also, saints who worked so closely with the poor, like St. Francis of Assisi. And so in Dorothy's room, there are a lot of images and medals and a lot of saint things, including, what we would say relics or things like this. But Dorothy was really inspired by the history of the saints who guide us and inspire us to do extraordinary things. But those extraordinary things don't have to be incredibly spectacular as some people like that word these days, but they could be just in the ordinary, that God can be active in the ordinary, that you can have a revolution in the ordinary. And I find that really, really, really challenging.
Talk for a few minutes about St. Thomas Aquinas. He had a doctrine called the common good, which she had, I think she tried to integrate that into her work, didn't she?
Yeah, I that fits in sort of a wider Catholic understanding of the whole, right? That if you understand, and Aquinas develops this political philosophy of the common good from St. Paul and from some and Aristotle and some other Christian and non-Christian thinkers, right? Someone who lived 1,000 years ago, a 13th century saint, Aquinas. And Aquinas has this notion that, government should serve the common good but what is the common good? And this is a question that many of us, that's very relevant to our moment today. Do we think of the common good only at our city level, at our state level, at our national level, or what about the global level? And, the Catholic tradition is going to have a nod to the global common good. In 1963, Pope John XXIII, who's a saint in the Catholic tradition now, who Dorothy was very inspired by, his writing a document called Pacem in Terris after the terrible risk of the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. In Pacem in Terris, John XXIII emphasizes the importance of the global common good. So Dorothy had a strong sense that while she focused on the local, she had this global awareness that transcended borders. And the Catholic tradition now is going to define the common good as the total of conditions that make for human flourishing. Some people in peace studies will talk about this as positive peace, if you will. Or we talk about this as sustainable development these days in sort of UN language. But Dorothy was very inspired by that notion. But her conclusion was not that we needed government structures to serve the common good, which Aquinas would be emphasizing. Her conclusion, we needed people and community organizations from the bottom up to serve it. So that's a really interesting challenge. But she saw the world beyond borders. And I think the Catholic tradition, a lot of Christian traditions, a lot of faith traditions do this as well. And Aquinas certainly did, that we have to look beyond just the borders there.
That approach seems to me it would be at odds with a lot of the nationalistic thinking in our country and in other countries around the world today.
Without a doubt. And, Dorothy in the 30s really committed herself to pacifism and the Catholic worker movement to pacifism. And as the drumbeats of war started to get louder in the late 30s with the Second World War, Dorothy recommitted the Catholic worker movement to a pacifist position. You can imagine that this was quite controversial, that she continued with emphasizing pacifism even after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And the Catholic Worker paper lost a lot of subscribers because they recommitted themselves to a pacifist position. Towards the end of World War II, after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Dorothy wrote one of the most scathing articles condemning the United States and condemning President Truman for being jubilant. And in her September 1945 issue of the Catholic Worker paper. And that, you know, she was sort of reminding us of the dignity of the children in Japan. She was reminding us that of human dignity, of that we are all human beings.
So would you say, I mean, it seems like as you're talking that I would say her faith really was beyond the boundaries of political and national concerns, wasn't it?
It absolutely was. And I think, you know, she didn't have much time or energy for things like the U.S. government or even something like the United Nations. She wanted, to create a new world out of quoting from the old labor movement slogans, to create a new world out of the shell of the old. And part of that new world is a world that goes beyond these idols of borders, these idols of nationalisms. And that, you know, that's a real challenging thing. You know, she would get, during the 1950s, there were these civil defense drills in New York City. And, you know, crazy sort of thing where everyone had to go underground somewhere, and they had these buildings with the with those radiation logos on it, and you could go into hide in case there was a nuclear bomb dropped in New York City, you know, as if that would save you too well, right? And she felt like those drills were normalizing or making a myth that felt of nationalism, but making a myth that felt like we could survive a bomb. That bomb was somehow normal. So she and other Catholic workers, Eamon Hennessy and others, they started sitting in parks, and they would get arrested. She served over a month in jail over those years at various times for protesting against the civil defense drills. Something unimaginable to think of, right? That at a time of extreme nationalism and polarization in the world with the Red Scare and all this stuff. And that's part of the reason why she got on a list, an FBI list of, and there's a whole big FBI file. Robert Ellsberg, who some people might know, the son of Daniel Ellsberg, who works with us in the Guild, who worked with Dorothy closely. Robert got a Freedom of Information Act and showed Dorothy her FBI file before she died. And we had to send that with the documentation to Rome for her canonization cause. And the people in the Vatican love showing off the FBI file. They find that very amusing.
You're listening to a conversation with Kevin A. Hearn, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan University in New York. And he's also director of the new Dorothy Day Center at Manhattan University. And you're listening to us at A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. And we'll return with Kevin in just a few minutes after this break.
Why not feed the people everywhere and let the peace begin? Turn your swords to plowshares everywhere and feed the people.
Okay, that's Stephen Still singing Feed the People from his album Man Alive. And today on A Better World, we're talking to Kevin Ahern, and we are talking about Dorothy Day, founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. What was the church's response to what Dorothy was doing with the newspaper and the hospitality house?
Great. Yeah, good question. You know, there were some of the bishops in New York didn't quite know what to do with her. And I think that's a really, as my students are confounded by her not being able to fit neatly in any one polarized category, I think the bishops were confounded by her as well. But they knew that she was doing something extraordinary to serve people who nobody else wanted to take care of. You know, the New York City Police Department would drop people off at the Catholic Worker who just didn't fit in anywhere else because they knew the Catholic Worker would take them. Dorothy, you know, would say that, you know, well, you could shut me down, but you're going to then have to do that. Who's going to take care of these people? So some of the bishops, even if they were challenged by her pacifism, especially during the Cold War era, they did still respect her. Cardinal Spellman of New York, who was a big sort of hawk in the time of the Vietnam War, especially in the earlier period, he and Dorothy disagreed vehemently on a lot of these issues. But he really respected the fact that she was trying to practice what she preached. She had integrity. And I think when we encounter people with integrity, I don't know about you, McNair, but when I encounter people who have real integrity, there's something spiritual about that encounter, right? There's something really impressive to even if that's not your thing, you're still inspired by it. So I think that was sort of the case there. There was one conflict where Dorothy sided with the with striking grave diggers of the Archdiocese of New York, and that created some conflict. But even in that period, she was not shut down. And so that, I think, is a really interesting dynamic. And now the Catholic Church in New York is supporting her cause for canonization. A couple of years ago, all the U.S. Catholic bishops voted for her cause, for her canonization cause. Pope Francis, this is the most incredible thing. I don't think if people remember this. In 2005, when Pope Francis came to the United States, this feels like a different planet ago, at least for me. He was invited by Congressman John Boehner, if you remember, who was Speaker of the House. And Boehner invited Pope Francis to come and address a joint session of Congress. And Pope Francis's speech lifted up four model Americans for all Americans to follow. He also talked about the importance of bipartisanship. But one of them was Abe Lincoln. Okay, that's an easy one. Another was Martin Luther King Jr. That's another easy model American. Then he talked about this contemplative monk, Thomas Merton. But then he talked about Dorothy Day as one of the four great Americans for people to follow. And that's just wild. That's just wild to think about this woman, right? Who, you know, she dropped out of college, right? She was a single mother. She never had much money. She voluntary poverty, right? And she's lifted up as an anarchist. She never voted as a model American to the most powerful people on the planet. There's something really interesting about that.
Yeah. Well, even Pope Leo, I think, was what, last November at the Jubilee audience in St. Peter's Square, he talked her up too, didn't he?
Yeah, and I was on a plane going to Rome for a series of programs about Dorothy in Rome that week. I was just couldn't believe it that he talked about that, talked about her. And that was in an address sort of that popes usually talk about saints. But this is, according to the folks, to some friends in the Vatican, this is the first time that a pope has used that sort of occasion to talk about someone who is not yet a saint. So this gives me a lot of hope that, you know, Dorothy's cause for sainthood might continue. And I really do hope that more people will learn about her, especially people in the United States, people outside the Catholic tradition, but also people in other countries. I think, you know, given the increased attention to war, to military spending, right? The president wants to increase the military spending budget by an enormous amount right now. I think, you know, a voice that says, that it says, what are we doing? That says, this is not Christianity, or this is not values, is something worth having lifted up.
So talk to me about the steps for canonization and the Dorothy Day Guild.
So the steps for canonization, it's like a legal case. So we use the word cause, but really that's the same sort of word as a case. So we have to, when someone is wanting to be considered for sainthood, you really have to start to build a case for that. And, you know, the Catholic tradition and a lot of Christian traditions who have attention to saints, right, aren't making the claim that only declared saints are the only ones in heaven, right? Pope Francis was clear, there are lots of people in heaven that will never be remembered, right? Maybe we can hope that everyone is there. But the purpose of sainthood is to lift up someone who we can have confidence as people of faith are in heaven, but that are playing a role as a role model and a source of inspiration for others to live lives of ethics and justice, or ethics and integrity. And so the New York Archdiocese began in the year 2000 an effort to start the process for this cause. And when a local diocese or a local group begins an effort, they get permission for her to be called Servant of God. So in the United States, we have other people, candidates for sainthood, who are called locally Servants of God. That process then involves interviewing people who knew her, if there is anyone still alive. For Dorothy, you know, she's fairly recent, so there are still people who knew her that had to be interviewed. Then you have to collect and document any documentation you have related to this person to make sure there's no skeletons in the closet or any problems that you might find. And so for Dorothy, this creates a problem because she was a writer. So she left a large paper trail, far bigger than anyone else. So we ended up having to collect, collate, go through, have theological censors of 50,000 pages of documents that were sent off to Rome.
And you weren't allowed to redact anything, probably, huh?
No, probably not. But it's all confidential, especially the witness testimonies, because we want to make sure to keep the confidentiality of this process. But hopefully, I haven't heard any sort of bad things revealed in this process. And, you know, the saints aren't perfect. They're human beings. So, of course, you know, if you have a story of someone who they got mad at the person down the street because they were having a grump, they didn't sleep well. Well, that's, you know, that's normal, right? Sainthood is, and Dorothy in her diaries even talks about, well, I was too harsh on this person today. I didn't get enough sleep last night, sort of thing. So we sent off this document to Rome. We have some lawyers in Rome who are working, going through these documents. And they will be submitting the final set of documents to the Vatican Dicastery, which is a fancy name for Office of the Causes of Saints, within the next year and a half. Could be sooner, could be later. And they will submit essentially a doctoral dissertation summarizing her life and summarizing these 50,000 pages. If that gets approved, she can be declared venerable. At the same time, we are collecting any reports of what we say miracles or graces and favors that people are sending to us about that they feel like they're praying or thinking with Dorothy, and they receive a grace or a favor. And we have a team of doctors and nurses who are investigating initially any sort of these reports. If one gets through the pipeline and we could submit it to Rome, if it looks good, if it matches the criteria, maybe then, and hope, God willing, she will be declared blessed. And then a second miracle is required to be canonized and to be declared a saint. So this could take, you know, decades. It could take a couple of years. You know, I'm excited that the venerable is looking like it will happen, God willing, in the next 2 or 3 years. And I'd be very happy if blessed isn't within my lifetime.
Round for my shoes. You're listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina, and we're streaming live at WPVMFM.org.
down from his shoe. Well, you tell about that now, baby. Yeah, man, I had to walk in blue. Yay! Some people said worry. Oh, blue ain't bad. That's the worst old feeling, you know I'm old. I most ever had.
Okay, that's Muddy Waters singing Walkin' Blues from the London Muddy Waters Sessions. And today on A Better World, we are talking to Kevin Ahern, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan University, and he's the director of the new Dorothy Day Center at the university. Kevin, we are in the final quarter of the hour, but I wanted to ask you kind of a more personal question. Has knowing about Dorothy Day, her life and work, changed or shaped your life? And if so, how?
Great question. I would say very profoundly as a parent. My wife and I, we have three small children. And, you know, looking for role models in the spiritual role models is a little tough because a lot of the declared saints in the Catholic tradition are celibate, priests, bishops, nuns, these sorts of things. And those are wonderful sources of inspiration for us, and our children are named after those people. But what often is missing is, okay, I would like someone who knows what it's like to change diapers, or who knows what it's like to take care of a kid who is sick in the middle of the night. Reading one of Dorothy's diaries, one of the things that strikes me the most is she wrote about taking her daughter and a daughter's friend to Coney Island they got ice cream in a hot summer day. And for whatever reason, that ordinary thing feels extraordinary to me. And it feels, to use sort of theological language, sacramental. So when I'm often frustrated with my children or feeling the difficulties that a lot of parents have when busy parents have, I say, Dorothy, please help me. Be with me. Inspire me. So that's one thing. But I often, you know, today driving in our local village and watching a line of people out the door at a local soup line, a local food pantry, I ask myself, okay, well, what am I doing as a Christian? What am I doing as a person who claims to have ethics and claims to have concerns? And so there is that mirror that she offers me to inspire me to be better. And I think those two things help as a parent and help to try to be better witness against war or better witness helping people directly. Those are things that on a daily basis shape who I am.
And I would also think to the degree that she's comes into your professorship and your teaching with students that you are influencing the next generation of people who are going to be shaping our society and our civilization, and her ideas permeate their lives as well.
Yeah, I feel really honored and privileged to be able to teach about Dorothy I try to do it every semester in various classes. And every time I teach, there's always at least one student who comes out transformed in some way. A couple of years ago, and I have permission from the student to share the story, I had this one student who, a tough New York student, she grew up in Harlem and was really, you know, was really a good New Yorker. And she came into my office crying. And I was like, oh my gosh, what happened? I didn't expect this particular student to cry in front of me. And she said she went down to the Catholic worker community, the house that very house where Dorothy Day died. And she helped to give out food in one of the lunch lines. And she thought she was the worst end of New York City and the toughest end. But she said, I had never spoken to someone who was poor. And she said, poorer than me. I'd never spoken to someone who was homeless. And she talked about how she had these terrible experiences with religious leaders. She believed that Christians were hypocrites, that they didn't practice what they preached. She talked about some terrible experiences she had as a kid. And then she said to me something that I would never forget. She said, something inside of me that was broken was healed. And I think that's the experience we have when we go out to people, when we encounter people, when we encounter people face to face, when we live life of service, when we live life for others. And that's, I think, at the core of Dorothy's idea of revolution. It's a revolution of the heart. It's a revolution that begins from below. It's a revolution that begins at a lunch line. It's a revolution that begins by saying yes to people and no to war. I think students see that. And so I'm always privileged and honored to be able to have those experiences.
So you kind of just touched on it, but I mean, is that the sort of thing that you think Dorothy's lasting legacy will be for today's world?
I think it will, like a lot of historical figures, whether they're saints or inspirational figures, the realities of the world are changing. And so I think that is part of her legacy, that we need to begin a new revolution from the bottom up. We need a new society. But I think also her resistance to nuclear war, her resistance to the instruments of war, her willingness to go out on the street and challenge the unjust structures and the unjust militarization of our society. Sadly, that seems to be a more of an important legacy in this particular moment. And I think we need, and people who claim to be people of faith or people of ethics can be inspired by those who stand up against the systems of war, stand up against the systems of oppression. And we know that we're not alone. And if you're a person of faith, something that's inspiring about saints is to realize that you have cheerleaders or people who are working with you. So even if you feel like the odds are against you, well, there are others who are there with you. You're not alone.
So just a couple of final questions. There's a lot on the web about Dorothy Day. Can you recommend any specific resources that people might go to find out more about her?
Sure. So there's a new beautiful book from Orbis Books by Robert Ellsberg, which is an edited collection of her spiritual writings. And Robert Ellsberg has written a number of books about her. One of Dorothy's granddaughters, Kate Hennessy, also has a great book about her time with her grandmother, The World Will Be Saved by Beauty. There is a website called the CatholicWorker.org website. This is a website that gives people information about all of Dorothy's writings can be found there. But it also gives you links to your local Catholic Worker communities if you want to actually get involved in helping to support the works of mercy. And then finally, the Dorothy Day Guild, which is dorothydayguild.org. That's the website working on our canonization. We have information about her, but we also have spaces if people do pray with Dorothy and they have any graces or favors that they want to share with us or prayer requests, they can put that on there.
And how can people find out more about your work and your books?
So you could go to Manhattan University's website, manhattan.edu/Dorothy Day Center, and that's our website for the Dorothy Day work. And happy to be a resource for people if they're looking to learn more.
Any final thoughts you'd like to share?
I think, you know, in our world where there's a lot of despair, I think a lot of people are anxious about the world that we live in. I would hope that we begin with the people right in front of us too sometimes, and we see that that we can change, we can make a difference, we can create a transformation of our society, and we all can do something.
Okay, we've come to the end of our time together, and I want to thank Kevin Ahern, Associate Professor of Religious Studies at Manhattan University, and the director of the new Dorothy Day Center, also at the university. Kevin, thank you so much for the work you do and for being on the show and talking to us about this astounding woman, Dorothy Day.
Thank you.
You've been listening to A Better World at 103.7 WPVM in Asheville, North Carolina. This is McNair Ezard. Thank you for joining us, and hopefully we'll see you next time on A Better World. And we're going out today with Jacob Dylan singing Lend a Hand.
Walk in the plains, west wind blowing, the waist high weak, sideways in the rain. A bloodhound sped, can't get no trail, ain't no sign. back the day.